Good afternoon, everybody. Good evening to anybody in the UK. Windows on the World here with Mark Windows. Today, we're going to be talking about something a little bit different. We're going to leave geopolitics alone just for today and go back into a bit of history, which might be revealing and interesting to the listeners out there. We're going to be talking about a book that was published in 1985, and it was written by Christian and Barbara Joy O'Brien. It was called The Genius of the Few, and it is the story of those who founded the Garden in Eden. Yes, at Karsag, where heaven and earth met, the heavenly assembly, the great sons of Anu arrived, the many wise ones. And this is based on the epics of Karsag and the Book of Enoch. We've got a very special guest today, Edmund Marriage from the UK. We're going to introduce him very shortly, but the Shining Ones, these people who set up this very advanced civilization, settled in this valley around 8200 BC, and their descendants set up this farming community in a whole agricultural system, and a system of law, a system of writing, and this is known as Sumeria. And these texts were in basically cuneiform. And Christian O'Brien was a very scholarly person, and he was, I think, the first person to actually manage to translate the cuneiform in any kind of exact and precise way. So we're going to be talking about that today, and I'm going to introduce Edmund. Are you there, Edmund?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, Edmund Marriage. So how did you get involved in all this? Give us a little bit of your background, not too much, and then we'll get into the story.
Well, I trained as a farmer and a land manager, and I had this problem of where did farming start? Where did it come from? Where did we find the first farmers? And so I knew that Christian O'Brien was a very bright, intelligent man writing about history, particularly the earliest Sumerians and their records. Therefore, I rang him up one day and said, "You know, what do you know about earliest agriculture?" And we had a little talk, and he said, "Well, I've just finished the main book, which was the book called The Shining Ones, which is a successor to The Genius of the Few." And he said, "I'll send you the proof, and you can have a look at it." He said, "I've only got 3 copies here." Because I'm getting such a poor response from the academics that I don't think I want to go any further at the moment.
This is anyway, a really good point, Edmund. Just wanted to jump in there because the response of academics is always incredibly disappointing. And apart from your chair squeaking, I think we're all right. the response of academics is incredibly disappointing. And we've talked about this. It's basically a hive mind, and it's very hard for them to see anything outside the accepted corridor of controlled opinion and knowledge. So this is definitely outside of that at that particular time. So, yeah, carry on.
So he sent me the proof, and I saw this fantastic book and realized how important it was. My own background is in research. I qualified in land management and wildlife management and agriculture. I was farming in the agricultural industry for 20 years. And so this particularly interested me. And I rang him up and said, "Well, it's absolutely fantastic." And he said, "Well, come and see us." So I went to see he and Barbara Joy O'Brien, his wife, who was my mother's first cousin. And I had a great meeting. And the conclusion to the meeting was, he said, "Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll get 100 copies printed. You can take 50 and distribute them, and I'll distribute 50, and we'll see what happens then." So that's basically what happened. But as soon as I realized the importance of his work, I basically felt that I had almost a duty to do all I could to promote the truth about our ancestors, about our religions, about the technology which is introduced to be able to farm brilliantly at a very early date. And it explains
how was the book
so
received, Edmund? That's an important point here. How was this book received at the time?
It wasn't received. The Shining Ones were only 100 copies were printed to start with. To be honest, there were very, very few people who could even believe it or even understand it. It was out of the league for most people. And I did send it to several academics. But the Genius of the Few, which is the key book, the first book, the first read for anybody, that has attracted a lot of interest, and quite a lot of copies of that book have been sold since I've been involved. But the problem was that the publisher of The Genius of the Few went bust, and therefore there was no marketing, no publicity for the first important book.
And now, another point I wanted to make, Edmund, was that the book is something that is very well regarded in certain circles. So that kind of explains why it didn't get much traction, because the people who were interested in this were probably very few and far between in the 80s. But from what I can gather about it when I talk about this stuff now, is the audience for this kind of information has grown quite rapidly. Are you finding that? Is there a lot more interest now?
There's a lot more interest. I've just sent two boxes of books to the book tree, Paul Tice in San Diego, and he has been principally selling Zachariah Sitchin books for a long while, and has said to me that this is the material that he wants to promote from his bookshop. And I hope that a lot of American bookshops will buy the books from me at a good discount, simply because the postal costs of sending individual books from my printers here in England to America are crazy at the moment. So it's got to be done through the trade if possible. And that's the route really to get them around, and we can do publicity events, etc. But the reason it is so important, in my opinion, is this is the truth about all religions. We can see where they've all come from. We can see why they've all gone in different directions, which is a disaster for the human race. And we can bring everybody back to a more realistic and accurate message about their brilliant ancestors. And that in itself is tied into the lore presented by the Shining Ones, which is way before the Mosaic Law. The steles in Suma were in every town, so that the people in those towns, if they had the basic understanding of the cuneiform, could read the laws in their own cities or small towns. On the stele, which is attributed to Hammurabi, at the top of it, Thorkild Jacobson, one of the great translators of cuneiform, says, just makes the point that at the top it says, these are the edicts of An and Enil. And An and Enil were the two top leaders of this group who were called Shining Ones. The word is clear.
Can we just go into where that came from, Edmund? Because people may not be familiar with that term. Can you explain how Christian O'Brien managed to get this term, the Shining Ones?
Well, the method by which Christian O'Brien got into this detail of the story was by discovering that the University of Pennsylvania in 1895, and two or three seasons of excavating the Nipah Library, and Nipah was the main administrative center in Sumer, which is on the Tigris and Euphrates. And in the Temple Library, as it was called, were these records, which were described by Professor George Barton, who was actually the Reverend Professor of the Bryn Mawr College in Pennsylvania, Quaker College. He was considered the expert who should translate these tablets, which were in the Philadelphia Museum in the basement. And he started to translate them. And by 1916, he'd got the names An, Enil, Enki, Ninkarsag, and he'd understood that the word Karsag meant head enclosure. But he hadn't got much further than that. And the Samuel Noah Kramer, 30 years later, 25 years later, made a point that these were very, very important documents, and that it was hoped that somebody would translate them soon so that we would know so much more about our history. And Christian O'Brien, when he retired from the oil industry in 1971, spending his retirement in translating this material, learning all about it, and doing all the work over the next 30 years before he died in 2001.
And yeah, so I just want to bring in the story here, Edmund. The story told by this epic is simple, progressive, and unequivocal, like the creation story in Genesis. It has seven parts, and at the end, the gods rested. A group of alien sages, referred to as the Shining Ones, arrived in a mountainous area and settled in a fertile inner montane valley. They called the general area Eden, and the place where they lived and worked Karsag. When they arrived, the local tribespeople were primitive. They wore skins and furs and lived in mountain caves. They were foragers and probably hunters. The aliens ploughed the land, formed enclosed fields, sowed grain of at least three different kinds, planted fruit trees and trees for shade, and liberally irrigated them. They domesticated sheep and cattle and housed them in permanent buildings with running water. The sheep and cattle prospered. The harvests were good, and much surplus food was produced. Man was invited in as a partner and a helper to share the bounty. A reservoir was constructed in the higher country to provide water for irrigation all year round. The aliens built houses for themselves, including one large, bright principal dwelling. So that's the kind of background of the story of what happened. And then, of course, it leads into the Watchers, who are like a subdivision of this group. And the book is very fascinating. I've had it on my shelf for a long time, and I've never actually got into reading it. And very recently, just started looking at it. So, yeah, can you sort of pick up where I left off there, Edmund, as to what happened when this kind of community started to thrive?
Yes, the first point is that Christian O'Brien looked at all the Ordnance Survey maps and all the data and reached a very clear conclusion that the site was below Mount Hermon, and the area where the water was stored and the land irrigated was the runoff from the snowmelt water from the anti-Lebanon mountains. And we have the story of the river that went out of Eden, etc., into other four other rivers. That was a mistranslation of a cuneiform. And what the cuneiform actually said was that a great water course was dug, and it was parted by sluices and put into irrigation channels. So we then have a practical way of looking at it. And I managed to see the Google images in 2007, and the great water course is there to be seen now, the outline of it. And I sent two people out to the area, and they looked at all the features in the area, photographed it. And O'Brien, of course, had used the French Ordnance Survey maps to identify the site. And now the site has been accepted by the Lebanese archaeological authorities, which is good. And we're trying to get the various organizations to accept it as a heritage site. The area is in the kind of area where we've got wonderful cedar trees, or did have cedar trees, and all the legends fit into that, with Gilgamesh and Enkidu going to the cedar forest, and Enkidu unfortunately killed Hawawa, who was the giant looking after the cedar trees, and they both spoke to the keeper at the gate of this area. And there's all manner of links in the chain to show that we know where this place is. We have all the references to it from many other historians, and we can now locate it. We go and look at it. We can get or should be able to spend money on archaeology on the site. Well, we've got the site of the great mountain house, which is on top of a high hill overlooking this basin, which they drained. We're looking here at the headwaters of the River Jordan, running right down to Jericho. And that's a key part of the story. It's not far away to the north is Baalbek, where they moved to Baalbek after they'd set up this agricultural training settlement, which lasted until about 6,000 BC. So we're talking about a time span from 9,500 BC with the adjusted dates. Carbon dating has been adjusted back. And so we got this particular site and all that went on at Jericho, where we find all the agricultural seeds and the domestication of animals in what is called the Levantine Corridor. And Jericho is featured here. And Jericho is the one place where Kathleen Kenyon, one of our greatest archaeologists, did a very thorough examination of the town of Jericho and found features, for example, a staircase in the tower, which would not disgrace any medieval castle, lime plaster, and the lime was crucial in order to correct the soil pH from the point of view of planting crops. We find the earliest fig close by at Gilgal. We've got wheat and barley, and we find so many other features there. And this changeover from hunter-gatherers to farmers. And the same situation further up the Levantine corridor, and the northern town of Aswad, not far from Damascus, where we've also got some of the earliest remains of farm crops. We've even got maize seed found on the northeast side of Mount Hermon, which is very important. The two Dutch botanists who found the maize pollen in a dry lake bed lost their reputations and their jobs almost before making such a stupid conclusion, because all the scientists knew maize came from America. Well, that is not true. Maize was one of the crops which was developed by the scientists at Carsag. And so we also have the expansion to Tel Nebi Mend or Kadesh to the north, which Kathleen Kenrin began to excavate and got down to the 8,500 dates, which is probably not long after Jericho. But these people were very well organized. We're talking here about what were called archangels, angels, watchers. And then there were Iggy, who were small and strong, the miners, who were tall, people who were later called Nephilim, who were in fact the people who had did all the strong jobs, and they needed to be strong and large. And we have a situation where we have
fantastically interesting stuff. My special guest today is Edmund Marridge. This is Windows on the World with me, Mark Window. 2-800-613-9443. See you after the break.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT today.
How healthy are your arteries? Deteriorating circulation has a number of early warning signs. High cholesterol, high blood pressure, fingers and or toes often go cold, arms and or legs often go to sleep, sharp diagonal crease in the earlobe, short walks cause cramping or pains in legs, memory is not as good as it used to be, ankles swell late in the day, chest pain after physical exercise or emotional stress. If you experience even one of these symptoms, your circulatory system is crying out for attention. Extendivite is a natural solution to help improve your overall health. Extendivite is not your average heart tonic. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com or find us on Amazon.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Welcome back to Windows on the World. A special guest today is Edmund Marriage. We're talking about the genius of the few, the story of those who founded the Garden in Eden. And we are referring to the Karsag Epics and the Book of Enoch. And the Karsag Epics were actually inscribed on baked clay cylinders with a diameter of 13 centimetres and a length of 16 centimetres. Now, we have these, I think, in the British Museum as well, and they're known as Akkadian, also Sumerian. But we're going back a little bit further than 6,000 years to 8,200 years BC, when these group of people, these advanced group, arrived. Now, Edmund, I just want to bring you in here, because where do you think these people arrived from?
They were survivors from a catastrophe which took place in 10,850 BC. And this is the impact extremely well described by Richard Firestone et al. And his team. When we had the Earth moving on its axis by 15 degrees and the Hudson Bay area being the North Pole and then the North Pole moving to where it is now, more or less. And so this was the time of the Great Flood, massive destruction. And it's interesting, Richard Firestone's book is called The Cycles of Cosmic Catastrophe. It's the key work, and it's something which fits into this overall picture, so we can look at what has happened and how these people were displaced from probably they were displaced from Atlantis. That is another.
Yeah, part that's
of
an interesting
story.
One. The Atlantis thing is something I have a bit of a problem with, as it was just a story. So I don't want to get too much into the speculation of that. But if you could sort out your squeaking chair, that would be very helpful too, because it's almost as loud as you are. But yeah, to get on to these Karsak epics, I've been reading this book today and I've been looking at it for the past week. And it looks very credible to me. And it does tie in with a lot of kind of academic discoveries and academic opinion about this period in a lot of ways. It's just that it goes a lot further. And it ties up a lot of things which, to me, were like loose ends, which is why I find it so interesting. So can we move on? I think we're going to have another break in a minute. But can we move on to the romance of Enlil and Ninlil? Because this is quite a big part of the story, isn't it?
Yes, the four key people are An, who is the leader, and the people of the god An, to Arpad and Ann. We have those traditions coming down, and we have key figures, say, is Ann, Enlil, and Enki, and a lady called Ninkarsag. Ninkarsag, she was the governor of Karsag. She was a woman governor of Karsag, and she was the daughter of Enlil. So we've got, daughter of Ann, and she married Enlil.
Yeah, she's also known as Ninlil, right? Yeah, Ninkarsag is also Ninlil, yeah.
She was Ninlil, and then when she was given the job of governor of the Garden of Eden, she became Ninkarsag. So those four were the key people involved. Enki fairly soon moved down to Jericho and administered that area. Enlil and Ninkarsag were at Karsag, but we find that the group of people dispersed to set up settlements at what was called An, and then on, and now called Heliopolis, which is Cairo. We have a group went to Ebla, a group went to Cutlahayak, a group went to Olympus, and you have this situation where they spread to those various centres. And if you look at the history of all those various centres, you find people like Berossus have confirmed that these people arrive to start civilization at those specific locations, particularly the Egyptian one. And so the knowledge spread. They had a training area, a school. They were teaching people all the various skills at Karsag, and it remained a center for the key figures for a very long time. And of course, we're talking here, the dates have recalibrated. The date O'Brien uses is before those dates were recalibrated due to a change in carbon dating methods. And so the date we started at Karsag is about 9,500 BC, and we don't get much happening in the Mesopotamian plains till about 5,000 BC. It's very important to see that difference, and it took a long while. One of the things that I've done on my Learning from History series, which are free of charge to look at on the website, which is www.goldenageproject. You can see the temperature on the planet. You can see the way in which everything developed and how hostile the planet was before everything settled down from 9,500 BC.
That's fascinating, Edmund. We'll be back after the break. This is Windows on the World.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
What What would you say if I told you we have a new tool that will increase production and lower maintenance costs for your meat processing company, and it would pay for itself in just 6 weeks?
When pigs fly!
The new EaseOff Model EZ4 replaces old spring-style carcass droppers and is faster, safer, and more reliable. The EaseOff lowers or lifts 1,000 pounds to or from your rail automatically using our remote control.
Sounds expensive! Can I afford it?
Can you afford not to try the EaseOff? It installs fast with just 3 bolts in place of your current dropper. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue and injuries, speed up your line, eliminate downtime, and increase profit.
How can I order my EaseOff?
Go to EaseOff.com, EazeOff.com, and hurry, because we are offering $200 off on the new EZ4 for a limited time. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too. EaseOff LLC, Summersville, Missouri, 417-932-6419.
Did you know that you can be tracked and traced when you're online? With identity theft and cyber crimes on the rise, your passwords, your identity, and even your physical location can be revealed to complete strangers. Would you like to surf the internet anonymously and not have to worry about these threats? Well, now you can by visiting patriotinternet.com. For about $2 per month, patriotinternet.com will conceal your IP address and your physical location, allowing you to browse the web, send emails, and instant message anonymously. Patriotinternet.com will bypass filters, block sites, and keyword blocking. You can also bypass logging by your router and your ISP. With PatriotInternet.com, there is no software to install and uses 128-bit encryption for your protection. When using wireless hotspots, PatriotInternet.com shields your information from identity thieves and is compatible with Windows, Mac, and Linux. Protect your identity and your freedom with anonymous internet access from PatriotInternet.com. Visit PatriotInternet.com today.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Welcome back to Windows on the World. Our guest today is Edmund Marriott. We're talking about the ancient civilization and the genius of the few, the story of those who founded the Garden in Eden. And this is very interesting because it brings up some kind of academic confrontation. And I always like that because we have uniformitarianists versus catastrophists. And really, when we look at the history of the planet, it has been very turbulent. So, Edmund, what I was going to ask you was, you'd mentioned Atlantis. Now, I'm always trying to find out the origins of where people came from and where they moved to. And to a certain extent, this is sort of documented. But what we keep finding are examples which blow it out of the water, which never actually get much publicity. And this seems to be constantly happening. So I'm just trying to get to the point here of who these people were. Now, on those cylinder seals, what I did know was that the people on the thrones were a good third taller, at least, than the people in front of them. So this now brings us into this area of the Watchers and who they were. Now, according to Christian O'Brien, the Watchers were a kind of sub-command division of this group. Could you go into that now?
Yes, the Watchers were craftsmen. and a whole range of skills required to run a civilization. We have the archangels, who were the seven headmen, and then we have the angels. The actual word angel in the Sumerian is En-Geli, which means lords of the cultivation. And then we have the watchers, and then we have the Igi, who were small with leather helmets, who were the miners, and the Gregori, or the Nephilim, were the larger, stronger people. And they all had very clear, defined jobs to do and were run extremely efficiently and extremely well to achieve all that they achieved, which was incredible in terms of a great deal of physical effort in digging these great watercourses at Jericho and in the basin below Mount Hermon. Now, the interesting thing is now for me is that Professor Peter Wagner, formerly at Port Elizabeth University in South Africa, I featured him on one of my Learning from Histories, holding Boskop skull. Now, the Boskop skull is about a third more brain size than us Homo sapiens. And his thesis is very important. He's just finished a book called Gods and Angels, and I'm going to be able to produce an ebook version soon, and there'll be a hardback version available as well. But he is one of the most qualified scientists in South Africa, with tremendous knowledge of South Africa. And he has come along and given full support to the O'Brien thesis. Now, I don't think there's anybody better qualified than Peter Wagner in South Africa. And now we've got that, what I call, fantastic academic support. And the other point about Peter's book is that he deals with the issue which has been worked on by a number of people, but the key point is that we have a genetic mutation which can be proven, whereby a group of people split off from our Homo sapiens and had a great deal more intelligence and brain. That's one of the points that's arisen here. And so that's something which is coming along in the pipeline. But
that is fascinating, because that concurs with a lot of the things I've been looking into over the years. And that's the sort of dot connecting that I like to see, because this is a huge thing, this kind of hybridization. And this is mentioned in the Karsag epics as well, I think. So this is a point which is very important, in that this sort of genetic modification of humans and sapiens is very key to what this is about. And I think that you mentioned earlier on these sort of books that were written by Zachariah Sitchin, which I don't really find that credible, but they do go into this idea of this genetic modification. Can you just kind of give us a bit of a sort of outline on that? Because it is mentioned in the first part of the book. It's actually mentioned in The Genius of the Few that there was this kind of hybridization. Can you just give us a bit of background into that bit?
Well, I'd just like to make one or two points which prove their very advanced abilities, which goes to prove, yeah, if you like, that they were exceptionally clever. And what we find right from Jericho and their first structures, we find a standard unit of measurement which we have used right up to the time when we went metric. So if you look at all the structures at Jericho, 9,500 BC, right the way through to the Mayan temples and many other structures around the planet, particularly all the what we call the Hyperborean structures, stone circles and observatories, etc., built in the British Isles, we find that the same standard of measurement was used. And so there was a simple formula to calculate it. It's all featured in The Genius of the Few. But we know from that that whoever introduced that was incredibly clever, far cleverer than anybody we've had in most of our history. Not only that, but we have knowledge that the Phoenicians were able to heat gold to 6,000 degrees to produce pure gold. And I've got a letter from Professor Charles Hapgood, which he received from the head of the Atomic Energy Commission in Britain, confirming that this evidence was that gold could be heated by the Phoenicians to 6,000 degrees, and that this had only been achieved in the last 60 or 70 years in the world as it is today. So there were two very important points there, and also we've got the whole record of farming, the seeds, the crops, including maize, and we find that all those were in place and all those were created at that time, and it's just part of a long list of incredible skills. We know that they were able to move these extremely large blocks and stones, and there's a great deal on that, and that's one of the other issues. We also know from Professor Charles Hapgood that the Earth had been mapped in the most terrifically accurate detail from the very early times. So Professor Charles Hapgood was a key figure in proving, along with Luigi Staccini, Tom Brooks, and particularly Christian O'Brien, had shown that their skills in measurement and surveying were absolutely incredible. Without even mentioning the zodiac, the Dendrozodiac, for example, understanding precession and probably understanding the switch in the Earth's magnetic field and the problems that creates. So we can actually go through a list of incredible science, if you like, which stems from these people, which proves the point that they were very advanced and very intelligent.
Yeah, this is a great point, because when I've looked into this Sumerian and Akkadian stuff, that is what really comes through to me. In the book, it does say Anunnaj and Ninlil made hybrids of themselves and the local people in the laboratory of the building of knowledge. Now, does this mean they were creating like test tube babies, or does it mean something else?
Well, I think it's described as in vitro fertilization. They clearly had this building of knowledge of which Ninkar Sag and Enki were in control of. And this is where we get the story of Adam and Eve being created in the laboratory. And then we get the story of Adam and Eve talking to the serpent in the garden. Well, the serpent was one of the wise, shining ones. The serpent being associated with wisdom and a whole range of clever scientific things.
Yes, Ninlil is actually talked about as the serpent lady.
Yeah, so you've got a lot of evidence, even in the Bible, of this extraordinary in vitro fertilization, which we're using every day in agriculture now. There's all sorts of ways that we are very advanced now and have learned how to carry out those kind of skills. And so, yes, there we are. That's more evidence that these people were incredibly clever.
It certainly is, and it's very fascinating. Now, you brought something else up here, which I think is a very major point, in that you seem to be averring to a civilization throughout the world which was advanced. And in your opinion, do you think this was all the same civilization? In other words, the megalithic building, this kind of ability to move these gigantic pieces of stone, as in Baalbek. Is this all the same group? Is that what you're saying? Or is that what O'Brien's saying?
I think this is just common sense from what we now know. If we look around the world and see very large stones being erected all over the planet, in even the Pacific Islands, certainly in Northern Europe, you know, and we look at the sophistication of the Great Pyramid, for example. Now, if we're looking at the Great Pyramid, we're looking at a mathematical model, if you like, of the Earth. We've got incredible accuracy there. And one of the really interesting features is the star shafts. The star shafts are from the King's Chamber and from the Queen's Chamber. And the Queen's Chamber star shafts point to where the North and South Poles were before the Earth was tipped on its axis. And the other star shafts are where they are now. In other words, they recorded in the Great Pyramid the Earth tipping on its axis back to the Firestone work. And we've also got to consider the cycle of cosmic catastrophe, which wasn't just cometary debris coming through our solar system and displacing Venus and destroying one of the smaller planets. But there's a great deal of information now on that from our astronomers. We can piece together, for example, the Carolina Bays is one of the examples, and the big strike hitting Hudson Bay, Labrador, another big strike on northern Finland and Scandinavia. And we've only got to look at the craters around the planet to see that we've been bombarded by large objects going back thousands of years, rather like the moon has been. So
yes, this is very interesting, Edmund, because I've looked into the work of people like Comyns Beaumont, which I find all over the place with what he's talking about. But there seems to be an element of unifying truth about this. In other words, this catastrophism versus uniformitarianism, which I brought up earlier on, the general academic idea is that they go for it uniformitarianism, which means that, in other words, things have stayed relatively stable. But this doesn't really make sense. It doesn't make sense with just what you've said, and it doesn't make sense when we look at the amount of debris that's hit the planet previously. So in your opinion, do you think that there was a kind of mass wipeout of civilization which was around or sort of after this period? In other words, if we're going back sort of about 10,000 years, this kind of Sumerian story and the Karsag epic seem to tie into also the period of the Great Flood. The dates of this are obviously debatable, but what do you think about all that? Do you think that these people were wiped out? What do you think happened, if anything?
Well, I think that they were lucky because we had a whole series of impacts over the last 10,000 years, and these are featured by Professor Victor Klube, who was the chief astronomer at Oxford University, and he featured the Taurid stream. And we know that that's every 2,000 years or so we get major impacts. But other work has shown the fact that we get magnetic reversals, which cause absolute mayhem. And they're something like every 24,000 years. And so the knowledge there is growing all the time about the fact that we live in actually a very perilous situation if we look back at history. I make
yes,
the point
and we see things in a very short period of time. Our lives are very, very short. And that's another point that I wanted to bring up about the length of the lives of these people. Because obviously, in biblical times, they're talking about people like Noah and Methuselah living about 800, 900 years. And there is reference in the Nag Hammadi scriptures, which were found in Upper Nile in Egypt in 1945, the series of 13 codices, that the watchers, the archons, shortened the life of people as a punishment. Now, I find that incredibly interesting because that also takes us into the story of the watchers and how they were in turn punished. And this does tie up with a lot of things because our lifespans are very short. We don't seem to be properly adapted to our environment. And we have all these health issues. So would you just like to address that?
Well, I actually normally try to avoid those sort of questions because I think they're so complex and it's so difficult to prove. And it may well be true, but we can actually look for so many other important, valid clues on the story that we're talking about. I think that the conspiracy theory thing has been around for a hell of a long while.
What do you mean by a conspiracy theory?
Well, conspiracy theory in terms of one group killing the other group, all the warlike activities that took place. I think it was far better organized than that. And I think we've got to be a little careful about looking at the negative side of what I believe was a brilliant, advanced, very good civilization.
Well, there's two sides to every story, so we're getting into that now. We'll be back after the break. This is Windows on the World, windowsontheworld.net.
This is too good to be true, except this time it is real. 100%. No joke. How about a $25,000 membership to Front Sight Firearms Training Facility as a thank you bonus for a one-time donation to RBN of only $500? It is a Commander Lifetime membership with no yearly fees or dues. The training is free for the rest of your life with over 50 different classes. Then leave it to your designated beneficiary. You provide the approved firearm, holster, ammo, eye, and ear protection. Many features and bonuses are included, more than you would ever expect or believe. This is the ultimate graduation present, wedding gift, etc., etc. See the details. Go to RBN's webpage and frontsight.com to make it happen. You will hear this offer only on this radio network. Help keep RBN alive. Tell five.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
Windows on the World. I'm Mark Windows. Today I'm with Edmund Marriage, and we're talking about the genius of the few, the story of those who founded the Garden in Eden. Now, there is a lot of controversy around this and about the Book of Enoch. These tablets, the Sumerian cuneiform, which was decoded by Christian O'Brien and put into this book, which was released in, I think, 1985. It's a really interesting read, and it does make some very fascinating points, and it brings into historical context a lot of the stuff that we know in the Book of Enoch and certain of the biblical stories, including, of course, the Garden of Eden. So the Garden of Eden is where we are talking about. The Lord planted a garden in Eden in the east, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and bad. Could you just sum that up for us, Edmund, because we've only got a few minutes left?
Yes, the great house, the Lord's great house, as it was called, on top of this hill, wonderful site overlooking the basin, had a very big garden area, if you like. And then further down the side of the hill was the building of knowledge, where Ninkasag or Ninil and Enki worked. And you've got a tremendous amount of obviously supporting people and a very, very efficient scientific organization going on there. And therefore, we've got a lot of extraordinary achievements at that particular time from those people, establishing very clearly that they were far more advanced, perhaps even than we are today. So that's...
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear from reading this. And also, they seem to have an advanced intelligence because they knew what they were doing and they knew how to do it. So they already had this knowledge. Would I be correct in assuming that?
Yes, they had the knowledge. They were having to start again, a small group having to start again. They almost certainly brought the agricultural seeds with them, and also the ability to domesticate wild animals, because that's what we see in the record from that sort of period of time. And we see that whole process of change coming about in what is called the Levantine Corridor, that is from Jericho to Tel Aswad, which is not far from Damascus. And of course, Karsag is not, they're literally 25 miles from Damascus across the Bekaa Valley. And so we've got extraordinary links here to great sophistication. And they need tabulating and looking at in detail. But the key point, I think, really, is that they were extremely advanced, far more advanced than we are today, in their social organization, in their role society. And they passed that to the city-states in Sumer. Now, if you take a city like any of the great cities, Mari...
Yeah, just round it up, Edmund. We're on the way out now.
Yeah. You've got 200 craft trades and guilds, and cities worked through those practical people.
Fantastic.
These days,
yeah, that's great, Edmund. Everything. We're going to have to finish there, but I'm going to have you on again. We're going to go more into this. I was talking about the genius of Ifu and the Garden of Eden today. Do join us Tuesdays and Thursdays, 2 p.m. Central Time, windowsontheworld.net. Check us out. See you next time.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. Well, we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country. Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store, or call us.
800-724-2719, extension 3. 800-724-2719, extension 3. This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.